From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
On the panel this week, Stephen Collinson, senior reporter at CNN Politics, and Laura Meckler, staff writer for The Wall Street Journal. Our moderator is the White House correspondent for West Wing Reports, Paul Brandis.
Hello, thank you for joining us, and here are the issues. The United States and China hit each other with more tariffs. We'll talk about the economic and political impact. President Trump wants to send U.S. troops to the Mexican border. Two big personnel moves in the White House. There's a new national security advisor and a new economic advisor. And don't look now, but the president's poll numbers are inching higher. Let's start with these trade tariffs between America and China. President Trump and China's Xi Jinping both appear to be playing hardball on trade. Trump hit China with tariffs. Xi hit back. We've had a couple of rounds here. It's good to see both of you, Steve and Stephen and Laura, but the ladies first. Laura, for our listeners around the world, break the story down, these tariffs and what appears to be a growing trade war. What's happening here?
Well, it does appear to be a growing trade war. I mean, we started out early this year with the Trump administration talking about tariffs on solar panels and washing machines, which were meant to hit China and among a couple other places in particular. Then it ratcheted up further with tariffs on steel and aluminum. There was a lot of pushback to that, but really from other allies, from China, that was clear that that China was the target. Then he talked about doing an even broader set of tariffs, and then finally China came back and said, "Well, okay, you're gonna put taxes on our goods, we're gonna put taxes on yours." Responded last month with about $3 billion worth of tariffs. Then the U.S. came back with a threat of $50 billion more in tariffs against China. Then again, it's just been a tip for, I feel like I'm just sort of repeating myself, but it's been a tip for tat back and forth all the way leading up into just recently when the Trump administration threatened another $100 billion in tariffs on China. So essentially that would be a total of about $150 billion. That's significant. It's more than our entire amount of stuff that we actually sell to China. So we're talking about a significant amount. And I think it started out as, well, this can be sort of a chess game that Trump can play. If, you know, we make these threats, they'll sort of bend to our will. And I actually thought at the beginning, maybe it would work out that way. Maybe China would say, okay, let's try to get out of this, you know, in a way that everybody sort of saves face, and maybe the U.S. makes some gains. But because there has been so much back and forth, and it does seem to be ratcheting up on an almost daily basis lately, you do sort of wonder if we are headed for an actual trade war that will have actual economic impacts.
You know, Laura mentioned a chess game. I think a chess game kind of implies a more thoughtful, forward-looking strategy. To me, it's sort of like more pugilistic, and Trump seems to think, Stephen, that you know, he's a tough guy, but Xi Jinping is punching right back just as hard.
That's right. What we've seen is this escalatory cycle, as Laura was talking about, getting more and more intense. I think one of the issues here, and this is something a lot of people worried about when they looked at the personality and the temperament of Trump, is that he's already personalized this. He's put himself on the line, his own image, and there's very few things that the president cares about more than how other people see him. So now he's locked into this personal one-on-one battle with Xi Jinping. I don't think it's clear that this is going to work politically for a couple of reasons. First of all, because Xi, as we now know, is the most powerful Chinese leader since Deng Xiaoping in the 1980s. And he has solidified his power base around him, and it's going to be—he's in a very strong position. And the Chinese system, I think, makes it quite possible that China can bear more pain than the United States can. And if you look at the way China is responding to this, it's going directly with its tariffs after the Trump coalition. These big tariffs on soybeans, for example, on pork. If you look at the most prolific pork and soybean producing states on a map, that's Trump's path to the White House. You're talking about the Midwest, decaying industrial areas of the United States, which are also very reliant on agriculture. So this is quite a sophisticated strategy by China. Already, before this, Trump's approval ratings in somewhere like Iowa, a key electoral state, were underwater because of his renegotiation of NAFTA. This, you know, These hits to the U.S. agricultural industry are going to really hurt him politically, I think.
We've already seen stories, in fact, some of them on your network with the hog farmers in Iowa, for example, saying, well, I voted for Trump in 2016. I'm not quite so sure I would again. So politically, perhaps a very risky strategy for him. Laura, where's this going, you think?
Well, it feels like, as Stephen said, it's like been ratcheting up, that it's hard and hard for him to get out of it. Yeah. You know, and that's the concern, is that you could essentially, you know, if he neither one of these parties is the type who wants to back down and say, and so the more they're dug in, the harder it is to get out. So I can't predict the future. I don't know where it's going to go for sure. But I do think that it's becoming, and certainly in the last few days, I think less likely to sort of end with a soft ending, and more likely to have these tariffs actually imposed and have these economic consequences spill out. And I think the thing that a lot of people have tried to warn President Trump about, and I don't think he's really listened much, is that these tariffs do have spillover economic effects that you aren't necessarily anticipating. So, for instance, you impose a tariff on steel or aluminum to protect the U.S. steel industry. But who does that also hurt? Other U.S. companies that use steel in their goods. So if they, then the cost of their goods goes up. So you've essentially protected one industry, but you've hurt many others. And the because our economy is so intertwined, both in terms of various products, but also internationally, globally, you cannot just, he seems to pine for a day when we were not living in a global world, but we are. So I think we're going to maybe have another experiment to see what does it look like when you do have some, I don't know if it'll be a full-fledged war, but it looks like it's not, it's far from peace.
Well, before we move on, here's kind of a thought. I just want to share this with both of you. And it seems to me that, I wonder if those advising the president have told him that America would have been much stronger if we had not left TPP, this Trans-Pacific Partnership, and then we could be dealing with China not one-on-one, but in conjunction with Japan and 10 other large economies. So this a go-it-alone strategy, how effective? I mean, that's what he seems to think is the way to go.
Right, and I mean, that's exactly what the argument for TPP was. You're in this massive agreement with most of the countries in the Pacific Rim, and you're setting the trade rules, and China has to comply to those if it wants to do business with that bloc. The issue is Chinese dumping. Now, the way to combat that would have been to have a united front with the Europeans and go after China that way. Trump decided he was going to slap tariff on the Europeans, and his administration had to hurriedly come up with this formula where there were opt-outs for U.S. allies. But this sort of vision of, it's interesting what you said, you know, he's against the, he wants to live in a world where there was no globalization. It's almost like the president has this sort of 1960s vision of the world where, you know, every town had its manufacturing plant. He's like a bricks and mortar guy in a you know, a digital economy. And that's, I think that really is a way of looking at how he sees the world.
All right. Well, we've got to move on here real quickly here. Let's move on to this border security issue. You know, the president has always said he wants this wall on the Mexican border, and the Mexicans were going to pay for it, and then he asked American taxpayers to pay for it. Well, Congress has not gone along. His latest gambit now is to send U.S. troops down to the Mexican border. What's going on here, Stephen?
I think in many ways this is, politics is driving this rather than necessarily the facts on the ground at the border. The president argues that there's this horde of refugees and undocumented migrants trying to get into the country. And that is, of course, one of the calling cards of his presidential campaign. He used immigration as a political weapon to communicate directly with a certain base of the Republican Party, which believes basically that America culture, and American values is under siege. So he says at least he's going to call up the National Guard and he's going to send them to the border to improve border security until the wall is built. Now, the question is, what are these troops actually going to do? How long are they going to be there? What's their mission? What are their sort of rules of engagement, if you like, in a very broad sense, and how much it's going to cost? The White House basically has been unable to explain any of that. And the fact that, you know, although there was a spike in people coming across the border in March, historically, the numbers are at very low levels.
Laura, these Republicans in Congress, Trump has been critical of Republican leadership for not giving him the money that he wants for this wall. He thought that, oh gosh, I have the majority control of both the House and the Senate. Hasn't worked out that way. Why not?
Well, for a variety of reasons. One of the reasons is his proposal for this big imposing wall is not that popular even among Republicans. So that's at least some Republicans, some important Republicans. But putting aside that, the reason is that the minority party does have some power in Congress, and they did need Democratic votes to pass this spending bill, and there was only so far they were going to go. Funding for this got tied up into this much more contentious argument over young undocumented people who came to the U.S. as children, so-called dreamers, who had been protected by the DACA program. There was a high-stakes negotiation that would have traded essentially wall funding for a path to citizenship for this group. Once that fell apart, Democrats were not going to go and give him the money for the border barrier anyway. In fact, he did get some. I was on some level surprised he got what he got, which is he got enough money for 33 miles of additional fencing and also a bunch of miles of 60 some miles of replacement fencing, which of course is, you know, far less controversial.
Well, it's important to remember you just gave a total of about 90 miles here. I mean, the U.S. border with Mexico is something like 2,000 miles. So he's really getting a very small portion.
Well, but keep in mind, the U.S., the 2,000-mile border, there's already 654 miles of fencing. That 60 miles is part of the 654. So you're talking about replacing miles where there is existing fencing, which is just a matter of making repairs. And that, I don't think anyone really has much of a problem with that. So if we're talking about expanding it, the numbers you should be thinking about, even though the White House is absolutely trying to spin this in misleading ways, the truth is that what we're going from is about 654 out of 2,000 to about, 690 miles out of 2,000. So, more, but not a tremendous number.
All right. Well, let's take a short break here. More issues in the news in just a moment.
Issues in the News is coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. A reminder that Issues in the News is available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. And don't forget to like us on Facebook. Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel. Stephen Collinson, senior reporter at CNN Politics, and Laura Meckler, staff writer for The Wall Street Journal. Our moderator is Paul Brandis, the White House correspondent for West Wing Reports.
Welcome back. People come and go in the Trump White House at a pretty rapid pace. There is now a new economic advisor, Larry Kudlow, a former television pundit. The president seems to like that. Also an incoming national security advisor, John Bolton, two very big jobs in the White House. Stephen, tell us about Mr. Kudlow.
You know, it often seems like the president is running some massive cable news network, because increasingly people are being brought into the administration, the White House staff, personalities from Fox News or other conservative networks. Larry Kudlow is an outspoken economic analyst who's been working for CNBC, the business channel, for many years, has a history in Wall Street. And the reason it appears that President Trump picked him was because he likes what he sees when Larry Kudlow is on TV. I mean, he's an outspoken, colorful character, a little bit like the president himself. What is interesting, though, is that, Kudlow has a history as a free trader. He's been on record as saying that tariffs and trade wars are not a good idea, but we know that the president thinks trade wars are easy to win. So you've already got that sort of clash between the America First nationalism, economic policies of the president prefers, and Kudlow, who's more, on this issue at least, on the trade issue, a little bit more mainstream. I mean, in fact, Kudlow started this week, and within the week, he had already been overruled on tariffs by the president. On Thursday, Kudlow was coming out to try and calm the markets, basically saying, look, these tariffs with China have not gone into action. He was implying that, this was a negotiating tactic, that it could all be diffused once you get to the negotiating table. Then 24 hours later, Trump comes out and slaps $100 billion of tariffs, or says he will, on China. So he escalated it. And you have to say, in the first week as an economic advisor, that's quite a worrying sign.
So there's friction from Day one.
Right.
All right. Well, John Bolton, meantime, is this new national security advisor, very hardline guy, particularly on things like North Korea and Iran. Tell us about John Bolton.
Yes, also another highly controversial pick. He is among the most hawkish voices on foreign policy in public life today. He has essentially suggested that we might want to declare war on both Iran and North Korea. He has been highly critical of the UN, where he used to be the ambassador to the UN. He was wrapped up in the manipulation of intelligence around weapons of mass destruction preceding the Iraq War. He is just a very, very strong voice for military intervention, and extremely controversial voice at that. I think it's sort of an interesting choice in that traditionally the National Security Advisor's job has been to take the views of everybody in the administration and make sure that the president has the wide sense of what where people are. The Secretary of State may think one thing while the Defense Secretary views it in another way, and to make sure he has all the information. When you have a National Security Advisor with such a strong point of view on these issues, I do kind of wonder whether he'll be serving that role. Of course, nothing really in the White House today is as it normally is. So not that I don't think we should be real surprised by that, but I do think that is something to watch. I think there's a lot of people who are worried that essentially you don't have anybody there applying the brakes to Trump's natural sort of hawkish instincts. We'll see what happens.
You know, one of the sort of the gold standards for this job was a gentleman named Brent Scowcroft from about quarter century ago, who served the first President Bush. And he said, to Laura's point, that my job is to kind of suppress my own personal views and give the president a wide range of honest options from which to make an objective decision on the issues of the day. Laura said that in John Bolton, that's not who we're talking about. What's your sense of him, Steve?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, I've been talking to quite a few people that have worked with Bolton over the last few days, and that is one of the great concerns that they raise, is Bolton going to give the president a wide range of views from which and options from which he can pick, because his record as a State Department counterproliferation expert and at the UN was rather the opposite. But having said that, people also talk about this. This is a highly intelligent man that knows the issues. He knows how to play the Washington game, perhaps more than anybody else in this administration. We're talking about a sort of a Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld type Washington veteran here who can get what he wants done and stop other people getting what they want done. The interesting thing is Bolton has always been the outsider in administration, pushing a more hawkish viewpoint towards a more traditionalist view, as he did in the Bush administration. Now he has a president who is hawkish, who is unpredictable, who isn't briefed on the issues like Bolton is. Does he still carry on playing that sort of outsider insurgent role in the administration? Or does he try to run things in a more sort of regular way? I think that's one of the things we have to watch. Also, his relationship with other key players. Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, who's been running Middle East policy in this ad hoc way, that doesn't seem like a great fit with Bolton. And his relationship with the incoming Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, who's close to the president and who's also very hawkish. So, you know, a lot of people are looking at this and seeing this is a war cabinet. Whether it works out that way, we'll have to see.
Well, some people, if you look at what Bolton has said in the past about North Korea, for example, he was actually right about what he said about North Korea 20 years ago. They were going to cheat. We can't trust them. That, in fact, is how it played out. So history has sort of validated some of these views. How's that likely to talk about North Korea? How's that likely to impact policy?
Right. So we know the president has this summit, which is going to take place either in May or June with Kim Jong-un, the leader of North Korea. The president is still saying he thinks he can do a deal. I don't think he's fully appreciative of the difficulties that such a deal would entail. But Bolton presumably is a skeptical voice on that. You know, he's had 20 years of history, as you say. One other interesting wrinkle about this, though, is that Bolton set up something called the Proliferation Security Initiative, which was a maritime operation to interdict sort of contraband heading for North Korea, weapons parts and weapons heading out of North Korea to places like Pakistan or the Middle East. And that's been very successful. So if the talks don't work, I don't think it's necessarily certain that we then proceed down a slippery slope to war. Bolton also has some sort of record in enforcement and blockades and sanctioning North Korea that could come into play. But the thing with this administration, as we've seen this week with the president's pronouncement, I'm just going to pull troops out of Syria. The president decides what happens. No one knows what he's going to do. That, I think, is going to be the case with North Korea.
In the meantime, the other kind of a prickly issue here for either of you who wants to answer it is Iran. There's no question, it seems, that with Tillerson out, the State Department, Mike Pompeo, presuming he is confirmed by the Senate, plus Bolton and the president, you've got three key figures who are very negative about this P5-1 agreement with the Iran. Is the Iran agreement, as we know it now, a dead, Laura?
Well, I don't know if it's...
Or is this in serious jeopardy?
I don't know if it's... I think it's going to be in serious jeopardy, you know, as long as Donald Trump is president. I think that he is obviously, you know, far from committed to it. I do think that pulling out is a very big deal, though, even if you do have people who would like that. And there will be pressure exerted from our allies on this front. And I don't think it's quite dead yet, but I think it's definitely something to watch.
Okay, we're going to have to move on here. You know, the final issue this week is the stuff that we've been talking about, this the instability, chaos, some call it, in the Trump White House. And yet, if you look at his approval numbers, they've been inching up sort of a tortoise-like bit by bit, and he's now at about an 11-month high here. How do you connect the dots on those two things, Stephen?
I think what happens, first of all, is that Trump's voters, the famously loyal base, don't really care about all this intrigue in Washington and the comings and goings. He's behaving exactly as they hoped he would behave when they sent him to Washington to be a disruptive force in many ways. But if you look at the polling, what you see is Trump sort of goes down to about 35%, and then he goes up to about 42%, say low 40s. What's actually happening is the movement is within Republican voters. So if he does something particularly heinous that sort of angers moderate Republicans, he goes down. And then he starts creeping up as more Republicans come back to Trump. You know, so he's now at around 42, low 42%. These are still historically low approval ratings for a president in his first term. A lot of the people in the White House have been making the point that he is now approaching levels that Reagan and Obama had in the first sort of year and a half of their term. But if you look at the issue here, in 1982, it would have been, Reagan was confronting a recession. In 2010, Obama was still dealing with the aftermath of the Great Recession. So that was pulling their numbers down. We are now in a position where, you know, unemployment is, 4.1% or whatever. We've got strong growth in the economy. Trump should be doing an awful lot better. If you have a president who is at 42% during an economic expansion ahead of a midterm election, that's not a healthy place to be. And that's one reason why you're seeing a lot of Republican lawmakers decide not to run again, because they think there's going to be a bloodbath in November. So if the economy goes bad, Trump doesn't have a lot of leeway.
On that point, Laura, there's this expectation that you know, there's going to be this wave in November with Democrats sweeping the Republicans aside. But to Stephen's point, the economy is actually doing quite well now. You're with the Wall Street Journal. What's your sense of just whether this a good economy could possibly blunt this presumption of a Democratic wave?
Well, I don't know with whether being with the Wall Street Journal gives me any better answer to that question than anybody else. But having said that, I don't, even with the strong economy, we've seen in some special elections, Democrats winning. So yes, the economy should be helping Republicans, and that is a very big piece that's in their corner. But there is a lot of other things that are pulling them down. So I think that it really is in spite of that. And I think if you talk to Republicans, they'll say the same. I mean, they are worried. So I think that when you look at President Trump's numbers, yeah, they may be inching up, but I think the point that Stephen made that they are still historically low. I mean, he's never had majority support from this country. I mean, that is a pretty important piece of information to just sort of absorb, and extremely polarizing. And people who don't like him really don't like him.
I mean, he was elected with only 46%, and it has never gone.
But even some of the people who voted for him didn't like him.
Yeah.
I mean, they just didn't like the other choice even more.
Interesting. All right, we'll have to end it right there. Our thanks to two of Washington's best journalists, Stephen Collinson of CNN and Laura Meckler of The Wall Street Journal. This program was produced by The Voice of America Current Affairs. Our engineer, Justin Thwaites, And I'm Paul Brandis of West Wing Reports. Thank you for listening.